Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. So let's continue where I left off last week. We left off with the question, if private banks are taking major risks, why shouldn't they reap major rewards? Banks claim that they are taking a risk when they extend credit, so the bankers argue that they deserve the interest they get on these loans, even if they did conjure the money out of thin air in the first place, which is kind of the basic concern here. Somebody has to create the national money supply, according to the bankers. Why not private bankers? What is wrong with the banking system as it is? So that's their question. Basically, just leave us alone. We're doing great. One problem with the current system is that the government itself has been seduced into borrowing money created out of nothing and paying interest on it. When the government could have created the funds itself, debt and interest free. All this activity we're seeing now with the White House and Congress, frankly, could have been avoided because what they're trying to deal with is the interest on the massive amount of money that we have borrowed. In the case of government loans, the banks take virtually no risk since the government is always good for the interest and the taxpayers are the ones getting saddled with a crippling debt that could have been avoided. This is really the essential problem that we are facing. Another problem with the fractional reserve system is simply in the math. Since all money except coins comes into existence as a debt to private banks, and the banks create only the principal when they make loans, there is never enough money in the economy to repay principal plus interest on the nation's collective debt. When the money supply was tethered to gold, this problem was resolved through periodic waves of depression and default that wiped the slate clean and started the cycle all over again. Unfortunately, that was a brutal system for the farmers and laborers who got wiped out, and it allowed a financier class to get progressively richer while the actual producers got poorer. On the other hand, it did succeed in lending a certain stability to the money supply, which, of course, once again, mostly benefited the financiers. Today, however, the Fed has taken on the task of preventing depressions, something it does by pumping more and more credit money into the economy by funding a massive federal debt that no one ever expects to have to repay, and this credit money is advanced at interest. At some point, and we are getting close to that point, the interest bill alone must exceed the taxpayer's ability to pay it, and the day of reckoning may not be far away, which is why we're seeing the battle. We may soon be at the point where we will have to consider some sort of paradigm shift if the economy is to survive. A third problem with the current system is that giant international banks are now major players in global markets, not just as lenders, but as investors. Banks have a grossly unfair advantage in this game because they have access to so much money that they can influence the outcome of their bets. If you, the individual investor, sell a stock short, your modest investment won't do much to influence the stock's price, but a mega bank and its affiliates can short so much stock that the value plunges. If the bank is one of those lucky institutions considered too big to fail, it can rest easy even if its bet does go wrong, since the FDIC and the taxpayers will bail it out from its folly. In the case of international loans, the International Monetary Fund will bail it out. In Sean Corrigan's descriptive prose, quote, "When financiers and traders get paid enough to make Croatius kvetch for taking wholly asymmetric risks with phantom capital, risks underwritten by government institutions like the Fed and FDIC, that is not exactly a fair card game," end quote. For every winner in this game played with phantom capital, there is a loser. And the biggest losers are third world countries that have been seduced into opening their financial markets to currency manipulation, allowing them to be targeted in powerful speculative raids that can and have destroyed their currencies and their economies and, down line, of course, their people. Lincoln's economist Henry Carey said that the twin weapons used by the British Empire to colonize the world were the gold standard and free trade. The gold standard has now become a petrodollar standard, as we'll talk about in the future, but the game is still basically the same. Crack open foreign markets in the name of free trade, take down the local currency, and put the nation's assets on the block at fire sale prices. The first step in this process is to induce the country to accept foreign loans and investment. The loan money gets dissipated, but the loans must be repaid. In the poignant words of Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, quote, "The Third World War has already started. The war is tearing down Brazil, Latin America, and practically all the Third World. Instead of soldiers dying, there are children. It is a war over the Third World debt, one which has as its main weapon interest, a weapon more deadly than the atom bomb, more shattering than a laser beam," end quote. The Third World is fighting back in a war it thinks was started by the First World. But the governments of the First World are actually victims as well. As Dr. Quigley revealed, The secret of the international banker's success is that they have managed to control national money systems while letting them appear to be controlled by governments. The U.S. government itself is the puppet of invisible puppeteers. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we'll look at how the banker's net spreads over the entire globe, and we're all enslaved by debt. As the witch said in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz to the lion, "If I cannot harness you, I can starve you. You will have nothing to eat until you do as I wish." So let's first look at saying goodbye, Yellow Brick Road, from gold reserves to petrodollars. And again, from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the winged monkeys, "Once," began the leader, "we were a free people, living happily in the great forest, flying from tree to tree, eating nuts and fruit, and doing just as we pleased without calling anybody master. Now we are three times the slaves of the owner of the golden cup, whosoever he may be." The golden cup suggested the gold that was used by international financiers to colonize the indigenous populations in the 19th century. This, of course, is referring to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz as an allegory on what was actually happening at that time. The gold standard was a necessary step in giving the banker's fractional reserve lending scheme legitimacy, but the ruse could not be sustained indefinitely. Eleazar Lord put his finger on the problem in the 1880s. When gold left the country to pay foreign debts, the multiples of banknotes ostensibly backed by it had to be withdrawn from the circulation as well. The result was money contraction and depression. "The currency for the time is annihilated," said Lord. "Prices fall, business is suspended, debts remain unpaid, panic and distress ensue, men in active business fail, bankruptcy, ruin, and disgrace reign." Now, Roosevelt was faced with this sort of implosion of the money supply in the Great Depression, forcing him to take the dollar off the gold standard to keep the economy from collapsing. In 1971, President Nixon had to do the same thing internationally when foreign creditors threatened to exhaust U.S. gold reserves by cashing in their paper dollars for gold. Between those two paradigm-changing events came John F. Kennedy, who evidently had his own ideas about free trade, the Third World, and the Wall Street debt game. In the book Battling Wall Street, The Kennedy Presidency, Donald Gibson contends that Kennedy was the last president to take a real stand against the entrenched Wall Street business interests. Kennedy was a Hamiltonian who opposed the forces of free trade and felt that industry should be harnessed to serve the Commonwealth. He felt strongly that the country should maintain its independence by developing cheap sources of energy. The stand pitted him against the oil banking cartel, which was bent on raising oil prices to prohibitive levels in order to entangle the world in debt. Kennedy has been accused of reckless militarism and obsessive anti-communism, but Gibbons says his plan for neutralizing the appeal of communism was more benign. He would have replaced colonialist and imperialist economic policies with a development program that included low-interest loans, foreign aid, nation-to-nation cooperation, and some measure of government planning. The Wall Street bankers evidently had other ideas. Gibson quotes George Moore, president of First National City Bank, now Citibank, who said, quote, "With the dollar leading international currency and the United States the world's largest exporter and importer of goods, services, and capital, it is only natural that U.S. banks should gird themselves to play the same relative role in international finance that the great British financial institutions played in the 19th century." End quote. The great British financial institutions played the role of subjugating underdeveloped countries to the position of backward exporters of raw materials. It was the sort of exploitation Kennedy's foreign policy aimed to eliminate. He crushed the banking community and the International Monetary Fund when he continued to give foreign aid to Latin American countries that had failed to adopt the bankers' policies. Gibson writes, quote, Kennedy's support for economic development and third world nationalism and his tolerance for government economic planning, even when it involved expropriation of property owned by interests in the United States, all led to conflicts between Kennedy and elites within both the U.S. and foreign nations, end quote. There is also evidence that Kennedy crossed the bankers by seeking to revive a silver-backed currency that would be independent of banks and their privately owned Federal Reserve. The matter remains in doubt since his presidency came to an untimely end before he could play his hand, but he did authorize the Secretary of Treasury to issue U.S. Treasury silver certificates, and he was the last president to issue freely circulating United States notes, or greenbacks. When Vice President Lyndon Johnson stepped into the presidential shoes, his first official acts included replacing government-issued United States notes with Federal Reserve notes and declaring that the Federal Reserve notes could no longer be redeemed in silver. New Federal Reserve notes were released that omitted the former promise to pay in lawful money. In 1968, Johnson issued a proclamation that even Federal Reserve silver certificates could not be redeemed in silver. The $1 bill, which until then had been a silver certificate, was made a Federal Reserve note, not redeemable in any form of hard currency. United States notes in $100 denominations were printed in 1966 to satisfy the 1878 Greenback Law requiring their issuance, but most were kept in a separate room at the Treasury and were not circulated. In the 1990s, the Greenback Law was revoked altogether, eliminating even the token issuance. Although the puppeteers behind Kennedy's assassination have never been officially exposed, some investigators have concluded that he was another victim of the invisible hand of the international corporate banking military cartel. President Eisenhower warned in his 1961 farewell address of the encroaching powers of the military-industrial complex. To that mix, Gibson would add the oil cartel and the Morgan Rockefeller banking sector, which were closely aligned. Kennedy took a bold stand against them all. How he stood up to the CIA and the military was revealed by James Bamford in a book called Body of Secrets, which was featured by ABC News in November 2001, 2 months after the World Trade Center disaster. The book discussed Kennedy's threat to abolish the CIA's right to conduct covert operations after he was presented with secret military plans codenamed Operation Northwoods in 1962. Drafted by America's top military leaders, these bizarre plans included proposals to kill innocent people and commit acts of terrorism in U.S. cities in order to create public support for a war against Cuba. Actions contemplated included hijacking planes, assassinating Cuban emigres, sinking boats of Cuban refugees on the high seas, blowing up a U.S. ship, orchestrating violent terrorism in U.S. cities, and causing U.S. military casualties, all for the purpose of tricking the American public and the international community into supporting a war to oust Cuba's then new communist leader, Fidel Castro. The proposal stated, quote, we could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba, and that casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation, end quote. Needless to say, Kennedy was shocked and flatly vetoed the plans. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was promptly transferred to another job. The country's youngest president was assassinated the following year. Whether or not Operation Northwoods played a role, it was further evidence of an invisible government acting behind the scenes. His disturbing murder was a wake-up call for a whole generation of activists. Things in the Emerald City were not as green as they seemed. The witch and her minions had gotten inside the gates. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa Bankruptcy, attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's take a look at Bretton Woods, the rise and fall of an international gold standard. Lyndon Johnson was followed in the White House by Richard Nixon, the candidate Kennedy defeated in 1960. In 1971, President Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard internationally, leaving currencies to float in the market, so they had to compete with each other as if they were commodities. Currency markets were turned into giant casinos that could be manipulated by powerful hedge funds, multinational banks, and other currency speculators. William Engdahl, author of A Century of War, writes, quote, "In this new phase, control over monetary policy was, in effect, privatized, with large international banks such as Citibank, Chase Manhattan, or Barclays Bank assuming the role that central banks had in a gold system, but entirely without gold. Market forces now could determine the dollar, and they did with a vengeance." End quote. It was not the first time floating exchange rates had been tried. An earlier experiment had ended in disaster when the British pound and the US dollar had both been taken off the gold standard in the 1930s. The result was a series of competitive devaluations that only served to make the global depression worse. The Bretton Woods Accords were entered into at the end of World War II to correct this problem. Foreign exchange markets were stabilized with an international gold standard in which each country fixed its currency's global price against the price of gold. Currencies were allowed to fluctuate from this peg only within a very narrow band of plus or minus 1%. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, was set up to establish exchange rates, and the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development, the World Bank, was founded to provide credit to war-ravaged and third world countries. The principal architects of the Bretton Woods Accords were British economist John Maynard Keynes and Assistant U.S. Treasury Secretary Harry Dexter White. Keynes envisioned an international central bank that had the power to create its own reserves by issuing its own currency, which he called the Bancor. But the United States had just become the world's only financial superpower and was not ready for that step in 1944. The IMF system was formulated mainly by White, and it reflected the power of the American dollar. The gold standard had failed earlier because Great Britain and the United States, the global bankers, had run out of gold. Under the White Plan, gold would be backed by U.S. dollars, which were considered as good as gold because the United States had agreed to maintain their convertibility into gold at $35 an ounce. As long as people had faith in the dollar, there was little fear of running out of gold because gold would actually not be used. Hans Schicht notes that the Bretton Woods Accords were convened by the master spider, David Rockefeller. They played right into the hands of the global bankers, who needed the ostensible backing of gold to justify a massive expansion of U.S. dollar debt around the world. The Bretton Woods gold standard worked for a while, but it was mainly because few countries actually converted their dollars into gold. Trade balances were usually cleared in U.S. dollars due to their unique strength after World War II. Things fell apart, however, when foreign investors began to doubt the solvency of the United States. By 1965, the Vietnam War had driven the country heavily into debt. French President Charles de Gaulle, seeing that the United States was spending far more than it had in gold reserves, cashed in $300 million of France's U.S. dollars for the gold supposedly backing them. The result was to seriously deplete U.S. gold reserves. In 1969, the IMF attempted to supply this shortage by creating special drawing rights, greenback-style credits drawn on the IMF. But it was only a stopgap measure. In 1971, the British followed the French and tried to cash in their gold-backed U.S. dollars for gold after Great Britain incurred the largest monthly trade deficit in its history and was turned down by the IMF for a $300 billion loan. The sum sought was fully one-third the gold reserves of the United States. The problem might have been alleviated in the short term by raising the price of gold, but that was not the agenda that prevailed. The gold price was kept at $35 per ounce, forcing President Nixon to renege on the gold deal and close the gold window permanently. To his credit, Nixon did not take this step until he was forced into it, although it had been urged by economist Milton Friedman in 1968. The result of taking the dollar off the gold standard was to finally take the brakes off the printing presses. Fiat dollars could now be generated and circulated to whatever extent the world would take them. The witches of Wall Street proceeded to build a worldwide financial empire based on a fractional reserve banking system that used bank-created paper dollars in the place of the time-honored gold. Dollars became the reserve currency for a global net of debt to an international banking cartel. It all worked out so well for the bankers that skeptical commentators suspected it had been planned that way. Professor Antal Fekete wrote in an article in May 2005 Asia Times that the removal of the dollar from the gold standard was the biggest act of bad faith in history. He charged, quote, "It is disingenuous to say that in 1971 the U.S. made the dollar freely floating. What the U.S. did was nothing less than throwing away the yardstick measuring value. It is truly unbelievable that in our scientific day and age, when the material and therapeutic well-being of billions of people depends on the increasing accuracy of measurement in physics and chemistry, dismal monetary science has been allowed to push the world into the dark ages by abolishing the possibility of accurate measurement of value. We no longer have a reliable yardstick to measure value. There was no open debate of the wisdom, or the lack of it, to run the economy without such a yardstick." End of quote. Whether unpegging the dollar from gold was a deliberate act of bad faith might be debated, but the fact remains that gold was inadequate as a global yardstick for measuring value. The price of gold fluctuated widely, and it was subject to manipulation by speculators. Gold also failed as a global reserve currency because there was not enough gold available to do the job. If one country had an outstanding balance of payments because it had not exported enough goods to match its imports, that imbalance was corrected by transferring reserves of gold between countries, and to come up with the gold, the debtor country would cash in its U.S. dollars for the metal, draining U.S. gold reserves. It was inevitable that the U.S. government, the global banker, would eventually run out of gold. Some proposals for pegging currency exchange rates that would retain the benefits of the gold standard without its shortcomings will be explored later on in this series of shows. The gold standard, however, was flawed, but the system of floating exchange rates that replaced it was much worse, particularly for third world countries. Currencies were now valued merely by their relative exchange rates in the free market. Foreign exchange markets became giant casinos in which the investors were just betting on the relative positions of different currencies. Smaller countries were left at the mercy of the major players, whether other countries, multinational corporations, or multinational banks, which could radically devalue national currencies just by selling them short on the international market in large quantities. These currency manipulations could be so devastating that they could be used to strong-arm concessions from target economies. That happened, for example, during the Asian crisis in 1997 and 98, when they were used to encourage Thailand, Malaysia, Korea, and Japan to come into conformance with World Trade Organization rules and regulations. And we will continue this analysis in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa.